Dallas Theological Seminary's Chapel Podcast.
During this week, we've been both enjoying and been challenged by the ministry of Dr. Douglas McConnell. He has been the dean of the School of Intercultural Studies at Fuller Theological Seminary and has now become the provost of that entire seminary. It's a tremendous challenge, an amazing privilege, and I still can't think of a better person for doing that than Doug McConnell. We first got to know each other when he was a professor at Wheaton College, and I lived and worked in Wheaton as well. And so we enjoyed each other's company. And then after I moved here to Dallas, now 23 years ago, we didn't have a whole lot more contact until earlier, about 7 years ago, we all sat down on a ranch down here in Southwest Texas and planned out a new book, The Changing Face of World Mission. You can find that in the school bookstore. And Doug has got 4 or 5 chapters in that book, some of which deals with the subject that we've been on and he's been presenting this week of the incredible challenge of the children of the world. And so as much as they are an incredible opportunity and have a great future, they have a very present reality. And a lot of that's not always pleasant. A lot of it presents incredible challenge and opportunity for churches and individual believers. So I look forward to this next lecture with Dr. Douglas McConnell, and I'd like to ask you to welcome him to our pulpit again this morning.
It's really good to be with you this morning. Those of you that were here on Tuesday, I'll continue on a bit from there. Those of you that I left dangling yesterday, hopefully I'll pull you out of that hole that I left you in. The sobering reality of some of the problems that we're facing in our world today. One of my favorite memories of my mentor in my doctoral program is of a time when he was joining us in Papua New Guinea. He was sitting at our table in the evening after having taught an intensive course all day at the University of Papua New Guinea with me. He came back to the house, Dr. Paul Hebert, in those days at Fuller. Dr. Strauss also studied with Dr. Hebert when he went to Trinity. But he was at our house, and I have 3 daughters, and the 3 little girls were around the table, and all of our friends who were from outside of the city of Port Moresby were staying somewhere on our floor in order to study with Dr. Hebert. You know how those intensive courses go. And so anyway, we were all talking, and Dr. Hebert would throw out a few sentences, and then we'd all wrestle with it. And of course, there was a little bit of sort of status seeking. We were aiming at a good grade. I'm sure you never do that, but we were, and there was a little bit of that going on, and we're all got kind of wrapped up in what we were saying, and the next thing we knew, Hebert was gone, and he'd just gotten up and left, and so were my daughters. And so I looked out the back, and there was Dr. Hebert playing catch with my 3 daughters in the back while we were debating some heavy missiological issue. And you know, over the years, I have found that the great ones, the really great ones, are the people who are able to talk to children. They're not too proud. They're not too above it. They're people who think more about children and grandchildren than they do about some of the issues of life. And there's just something incredibly endearing about a person who cares about children. I've seen it all over the world. I never forget one time when my daughter and I were in the Forbidden City in Beijing, China, my youngest daughter. We'd gone on a trip to Japan where I did some lecturing, and then Beijing, and then we went up to Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia, where we taught for about a month. And she was about 18 at the time, and we went through the Forbidden City, and it is formidable, very formidable. If you haven't been there, it's a worthwhile destination. When we got out on the other side, there on the street was corn that had been cooked over an open fire. Now, in Papua New Guinea, that's a treat. And so my daughter saw it, and she said, "Oh, Dad, let's get some corn. Let's think about that." Well, you know, usually I somewhat avoid street food, partly because it generally sends home flora and fauna that I didn't bring with me. But anyway, we decided to go for that, so we went over and got some corn. And before we could get it in our hands, a little child was pressing up against my leg with his hand out, looking up into my face with a hungry face, and in fact wanted the corn. So I gave the corn to the child, and the next thing I knew, I took one and started to hand it to my daughter. Another little hand came up and took that one, and before I knew it, we had a whole pack of kids around us, all standing there. It's estimated that there's between 10 and 100 million children living on the streets of the world. And lest you think that only takes place in faraway lands, I would challenge you to go to the parking lots of the major supermarkets and malls after about 11 o'clock at night. You're going to see two things. You're going to see kids on skateboards, usually beating up on rails and things like that. And then you're going to see a group of other kids hanging around. And if you've got the tenacity to stay all night, my guess is that they will be there too. I've seen it in California. I've seen it in Texas and Houston. I've seen it in Orlando, Florida. I've seen it all over the country and all over the world. Kids with no place to go. So when we start thinking about children at risk, which is the context and the reflections that I'm having this week, we've got to come to grips with the fact that this is not locked in history. This is not something that used to happen. This is not something that is a phenomenon of over there. This is a global phenomenon, and it's happening over and over again. Just one other statistic. I read an article about child prostitution. And the article was written by a person named Lois Lee, and she wrote the article about her ministry. And she stated in that article that her ministry had touched over 10,000 children who had been caught up in prostitution. 10,000 children. Have a guess where that was. Bangkok? Good guess. Manila? Reasonable guess. Delhi? Maybe. San Fernando Valley, California. You know what else is in San Fernando Valley, California? Hollywood. Those kids are coming in looking for anything they can get, and what they're finding is that selling their body is a pretty lucrative trade. Brothers and sisters, we live in a world that has some very crushing realities, and it's easy for us to insulate ourselves in ways that protect us from that. And the one thing that God has allowed me in the last 30, almost 35 years of being a missionary and a missionary teacher has been to see a lot of this up close and personal. And so when I bring this to you today, I'm not bringing you some distant thought. I'm bringing you something that flows in the DNA of my body. I started out as an elementary school teacher. I've told you that. My students have gotten progressively older over the years. Most of my students are PhD students right now, and they don't look anything like kids. In fact, to have any fun with them, I have to get them to bring their families so I can play with their kids, because all they want to talk about is some theorist. But it is an interesting experience for me. So I want to share one of the more tender passages of Jesus's rebuke of our arrogance. And it's found in chapter 9 of the book of Luke. Now, if you don't know the book of Luke, I'm going to tell Dr. Bach, because about every third commentary he's either written or contributed to. And by the way, in a wonderful way, I'll quote him a little bit later. Chapter 9, verses 46 to 48. We'll just take a small portion. An argument arose among them as to which one of them was the greatest. But Jesus, aware of their inner thoughts, took a little child and put it by his side and said to them, "Whoever welcomes this child in my name welcomes me. Whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me, for the least among all of you is the greatest." My appointment at Fuller Seminary is in the field of leadership, intercultural leadership, and I treated this passage more often than not as a passage reflecting on how we should view leadership and how we should think about being leaders and some of the implications of servant leadership. And there's some appropriate applications there. But I began to read it afresh one time when I got back from Europe, and I had spent particularly difficult time with Hungary, in Budapest, and got to see the seamy side of Budapest for children. And I came home and I started thinking about Jesus welcoming that child. So I'd like to reflect on that a little bit with you this morning, and then I'd like to reflect on how that turns from a kind of a vignette of Jesus with his disciples into a perspective on how we understand the story of children in our world. Jesus was walking with his disciples. He had just revealed again to them that his future was not all that they thought it would be. Now, remember the setting. The setting was the people of God under Roman rule. Now, many of us in this room today know nothing of living under a foreign occupying body. I can remember over the years traveling to places like Lebanon, where before the Syrians pulled out, about every few blocks, there were Syrians standing with guns, kind of keeping watch over Lebanon. Or when I was in Bosnia and I could see the peacekeeping troops, which is somewhat of an ironic use of that word, peacekeeping, because they are armed to the teeth. They have guns, they have gunships, they have helicopter gunships. In fact, when I first landed in Sarajevo, the banner from the Winter Olympics was still in the airport. You know what it said? Welcome to Sarajevo. This welcome topic. Welcome to Sarajevo. I got off the plane, and as I looked across, there were helicopter gunships, there was a troop carrier, there were armed guards. I walked into the place, all the computers were down, nothing worked, so they wrote down my passport number in pencil. That's how destitute it was. It was absolutely devastated by that civil war. In fact, we went, as we were going into the city, we drove up near the one neighborhood, and there were some apartment buildings. And my wife wanted to take a picture because in one apartment building, half of the building was completely in ruins and the other half looks like it was perfectly all right. And it was just blown up completely on that one side. So she took a step back in order to get the vantage point with the camera, and she was grabbed by a fairly large Bosnian and pushed back into the street. So being the chivalrous man I was, I stepped away. And he was big. I mean, what am I going to do? No, actually, I didn't. I wondered what was going on. And he said in broken English, "We haven't swept this area for mines yet." This was a neighborhood. This was a neighborhood. We drove on into the city, and there in the middle of the city was a building that was so devastated, I've never seen anything like it anywhere in my life. It was completely rubble. There wasn't one brick on another brick as it was before. It was just shredded. It took up a whole city block, and I asked, "What was that?" My friend said, "That was the daily newspaper building." And I thought about daily newspaper building, and I thought, what in the world would they want to bomb that out? And the reason was because a group of diehard, committed Bosnians camped out in the basement of that building, and every night, under the cloak of darkness, would slip out and take a newspaper giving the actual report of what was going on in Bosnia. And the people who were conquering didn't want that news to get out. Now, if they took that much effort to get the bad news out, how much more should we give ourselves to welcoming those with the good news of the one who would take a child and put in their midst? Do you see the connection? It's an interesting perspective, but these disciples were together, they were wrestling, they were arguing really about who was going to be greatest. And this was not uncommon for anybody. It isn't uncommon in our world today. In fact, I often, with my colleagues, will come upon a conversation where there's a little one-upmanship going on about the latest publication. I'm sure that doesn't happen at Dallas, and it might not happen at Fuller because this is being recorded, but then again, it might. And it did happen at Wheaton, I can tell you that right now. There is a kind of a status thing that goes on. Deborah Tannen, in her view of communication theory, talks about two principal types of communication. One is asymmetrical, in which you're trying to elevate your status. And predictably, she would say that is typically a male communication style. And then there's symmetrical, in which you're trying to gain a relationship. You're trying to get to know one another and bond. And she, of course, said that that was a more female communication style. Having raised three daughters, I think she's probably right. My girls would talk all night long, and I never could understand if they said anything, but they were talking, and they felt good about it and good about each other, and I don't know, it never solved any problems that I saw, but anyway, good relationships. But there's something about that willingness to touch somebody at a relational level, but the disciples weren't doing that. They were competing. Who's the best? Who's the greatest? And Jesus heard that, and keep in mind, he had just said, just prior said, "Let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into human hands." That was ringing in their ears, and they're having this conversation. So Jesus listened to this, and then it says in verse 47, "But Jesus, aware of their inner thoughts, took a little child and put it by side." Now, one of the themes that we've been touching on through this week is the fact that children were not of the same status as adults in that time. Children were of a lesser status, and the opinions of children ranged. It went all the way from a blessing in the Jewish home. Children were a blessing and to be sought after, through to what was quoted by the Roman philosopher Cicero as, the thing itself cannot be praised, only its potential. He couldn't even give it a kind of a personal pronoun. It had to be an it. The thing itself cannot be praised, but only its potential. The view of children was that they weren't of the same status. And Jesus was able to take that child and bring the child in the midst. Now, the conversation turned at that point, as you might imagine it would. Jesus had a way of doing things in a demonstrative fashion that kind of quelled the conversation a bit and pulled the focus in. So he did that, and the child came into the midst. And then he said, whoever welcomes this child in my name welcomes me. What a powerful, powerful statement. Powerful statement. The welcoming of the Messiah is like welcoming a child. Can you get the feel there? This is the one who was going to the cross. This is the one who was prepared to bear the wrath of God. This was the one who was the holy sacrifice, who would die. That same one. Welcome the child, you welcome me. Now, I don't want to play this too far, because you could play this out to become, you should all be children's pastors and that's it, which I think Dr. McLaughlin would appreciate, and you would, yeah, I've got a lot of people saying that would be a good idea here, but let's not push it that far. But let's simply point out that Jesus was trying to get the view off of themselves into a bigger kingdom perspective. And part of that kingdom, as we saw yesterday, includes children. God was giving the opportunity for us to understand that the welcoming of those that are on the margins is a way of demonstrating our embrace of the Messiah. You see that connection? It becomes incredibly important. And then he goes on to top it by saying, and whoever welcomes me welcomes the one who sent me, for the least among all of you is the greatest. Jesus was pointing out that in his kingdom, the great are not the focus. The great are the ones who will give to others, who empty themselves, familiar Philippians 2, who give themselves in ministry and care and welcoming to others. He is calling us to a lifestyle that is so radically different than our status orientation that we have today. In his treatment of this passage, Dr. Box said this, Jesus' point is that everyone, even the lowest person on the ladder, is important. He goes on to say, receiving a child is like receiving God. The effect of Jesus' words is to rule out debates over status. Greatness comes from one's status as human being, as one created by God. Brothers and sisters, we have an identity crisis in the world today. You have it and I have it. It's estimated that when a man particularly becomes unemployed, it affects women as well. But when a man becomes unemployed, he loses not only his income, but his identity. And if you ask somebody, who are you? Almost inevitably, they will tell you what they do. In the rough and tumble of political debates and all of our pressures that we feel today, more often than not, when we're communicating, we're not communicating about an issue or about the justice or mercy of God or righteousness in the particular issue. We're often partisan in the way we talk about it. And God is calling us to a lifestyle that turns that over and says, I am first and foremost a child of God. From that I draw my identity. From that I live my life. From that perspective, I can embrace other. Because when I embrace the other with a welcome of God, the other is no longer other. The other has been invited in. And that's the heart of evangelism. It's the witness that invites people in. Come to know the Savior. It's the embrace. And more often than not with children, it has to be demonstrated. It's probably true of adults as well. Kids need to see it because they see so much junk. They see so much hypocrisy, so much promise of one thing and delivery of something else. And what they're looking for is a reality that they can hang on to. And often, it's a glancing blow from many of us. So when we begin to think about this welcoming, we've got to get past the kind of idea that this is just a one-off, you know, like, welcome to my house. One of the things that internationals will feel, and particularly those of you from Africa and Asia, when you come here, we talk about friends and we'll call you friend and everything like that, but we don't do it well, do we? We really don't. You know, in Africa, when you say friend, what's yours is mine. In America, when we say friend, what's yours is yours, and keep it off my yard. Because I insure all the junk in my fence. There's a different thing going on. Now, one of the things we need to remember, and I want to remind you of that passage in Deuteronomy when God was saying that the parents, that they pass it on to their children, one of the things that we have to remember is that was a very collectivist society. That was not me individual, turn it to my children only. That was the nation. It was the community of people. It was the group. And part of what we have to do when we start looking at ministry to children at risk is recognize we don't do it alone. Because the truth is, you not only cannot do it alone, you will fail if you do it alone. We have to do it together. So when Jesus took this child, put it in the midst, and said to them, think about this. When you welcome this child, you welcome me. Think about your world and how you engage with your world. Now, there's more that we could say there, but I want to move on to some of the way this plays out. But before I do, just one thing. When you read about children and children at risk, more often than not, the rhetoric will be around the concept of a problem. Children as a problem, street children as a problem, gangs as a problem, violence as a problem, drugs as a problem. And the children embody that problematic identity. And so in one way we say to children, welcome, but just remember you're a problem. And that kind of problem orientation, in fact, in the discipline of psychology, they have moved away from what they used to call dysfunctional psychology or dysfunctional family structures, and now they're beginning to study positive psychology. And I'm not talking about I'm okay, you're okay stuff. They're beginning to study the fields of positive psychology to say what resources are needed for a human being to flourish rather than how do we mark the deficit. You see the difference? And it has turned out some wonderful, wonderful insights. This whole idea of asset and thriving has really revolutionized the way we look at children. It's beginning to affect our understanding of education. It's been a real transformation. I think that's what Jesus was doing. Welcome these children. Make them feel not as a problem, not as something to be pushed away, but something to be embraced and put in the middle. Now, there is one other thing I want to touch on. To my brothers and sisters who are the professors here, one of the things that I would like to encourage you to think about in your teaching and in your reflections and in your scholarly work is not to switch all of your focus to produce all the books on children. But when you do your Old Testament studies, when you do your book studies in the New Testament, when you study homiletics, when you are doing hermeneutical process and method, start thinking about the fact that there will be children present in the group of people that handle that material. There will be children present and receiving some of the teaching that you give to them. And I think if we started to think a little bit more about children as part of the entire thought pattern, we are obviously thinking about the audience who will read our studies, who will read our books, put a child in the midst. If we could do that just a little bit more, we wouldn't have to have all these messages that are so focused on such a terrible problem. I think we begin to address it a little bit more holistically, and we need to do that. But that's a little digression. You do the same as students. One other thing. We're trying not only to change the conversation about children, but we're beginning to look at how we tell the story, kind of the narrative. And one of the things that we've begun to look at is something that Martin Marty introduced. And if you know Martin Marty, he's a Chicago theologian, not always top of the list of ranking evangelicals, but a wonderful writer, and by the way, one of the best writers. He has an outstanding writing style. He wrote a book called The Mystery of the Child, The Mystery of the Child, and what he tried to do was he tried to get us away from seeing caregiving as response to problem and begin to see children as somehow part of the mystery of God's creation, to celebrate the image of God as it plays out in children. Now, obviously, there are some dimensional challenges to that, but getting away from problem and going to the fact that these kids are created by God, and they have something of God's presence in them. Now, I don't want to push that too far, but at least we need to move to a point where we look at children and we don't see them and categorize them as the next problem to be dealt with. And so he writes, and I quote, "If instead of seeing the child first as a problem faced with a complex of problems, we see her as a mystery surrounded by mystery, the need to deal with problems will, of course, be pressing in the case of every child. But if the need dominates the thoughts and actions of those who provide care, much of the wonder and joy relating to children will be shrouded and even lost." One of the things that I have seen when we start working with children, particularly orphans, is that you just see the insurmountable problems of economics, of personal identity, of protection, of security, of all the things that can happen when they get swept up into war, just all the dimensions. And you pretty soon forget that they are actually little kids, that they are kids that have lives and can play and enjoy. I've seen children play in a trash dump with boards with nails in it, and I've seen them take a broken soccer ball and have an entire soccer game and pretend for all the world like it was Cape Town 2010. Remarkable. I've seen kids take a broken bicycle rim and a stick and push that thing for miles as part of a game. Just running, running, running. Someone said that may be the answer to Kenyan long-distance runners. Who knows? Because you see kids running behind wheels everywhere. But the interesting thing is in the midst of that environment where it is so devastated, children can make a game. And if we can start to see kids a little bit more with the mystery and a little bit less as a problem to be solved, it could transition us. So I want to focus, with the time that I have remaining, and that's not much, on this concept of orphans and the problem, simply because I want to weigh into the passages that we've been looking at. But that isn't the only type of child at risk. But I want to begin to look not just at the statistics of problem, but at some of God's way of handling through his people in the ages, through the ages. The first is by a German, and I will butcher the pronunciation of his name, but I will do it with great gusto. A.H. Franke. He lived as a university professor in Halle in Germany, taught at the university there, was, in fact, one of the leading minds of the time. In fact, William Gage, in his biography of his biographical comments on Franke in 1857, wrote this: "He was a profound scholar, an eloquent preacher, a correct thinker." It sounds like something we'd say here, a correct thinker. That's good. "And a man of wonderful energy and organizing power." That was his comment about Franke. Now, the interesting thing about Franke is he worked at this university. He was a bright person, but he would walk every day past children that were hungry. They were in the streets. They had no opportunity for any kind of help. And he himself was undergoing a real serious transformation. In fact, he and another leader by the name of Spener were really the ones that kind of got the Pietist movement going in Germany. They were very much part of that. He was a man who was really embracing God and living for God, a kind of A.W. Tozer of that time, a person who was really learning what God was teaching him. And he saw these children, and the more he saw them, the more he was committed to do something about it. And so the first thing he did is he decided with the orphans to organize some of his friends to take the orphans into his house. So he started a kind of a fostering program. It was really the first that we know of recorded. So he began this fostering program to bring people in, but he found that it wasn't sustainable. People would bring in children, but it was just so disruptive that they couldn't continue it, and it was very expensive. And so the more he looked at it, the more he struggled with that, but his heart was breaking for these children. So he began what became an astounding orphanage. And the interesting thing is the way he paid for it. Because he at first gave his own money, but then it ran out. He couldn't sustain it, and he didn't know what to do. And he had this dynamic understanding of who God was and God's answer to prayer. So the more he prayed, the more he thought, no, God would have me not go out and ask so much. And he did a few times, but he constructed what he called a poor box. And he put the poor box outside and he prayed, God, bring in money. And the story is just remarkable. I was reading it again this morning. It's in Google Books. You can download it. And I was just reading it again this morning. And just so interesting the way the first one was just a few cents. And each day a few more cents. And before too long, he was able to cultivate a giving pattern. And people would actually come that hadn't heard of him before and give money for the sake of the orphanage. And as it progressed, he ended up building that building, which for many, many decades, perhaps even several centuries, was the largest building in that part of Germany. It was an orphanage. In 1860, now that was built long before that, over almost 200 years before that. In 1860, Gage, when he visited, said, in 1860, the school was continuing, drawing on the funds left by Franca, continuing to serve nearly 4,000 children with a core of almost 200 teachers, most of which lived in the building. Staggering, staggering commitment. So that's one response, just one. In the 18th and 19th century, many of you will be well aware of the work of John Wesley and the Wesleyan revival, and those of you who are Methodists can take pride right now. Because one of the things that Wesley did in his passion for the lost, in his passion for seeing people become on fire for God, was to start working with orphanages and working with children on Sundays and these rag schools. And they were fairly common and beginning to grow out, and he pushed that and he worked with it. It was a fairly common practice. And the Wesleyans did that. They did it in the Pacific. As they came, they started schools. I've been in many of them. I was in Fiji, and I went to a Methodist school that was built by the early missionaries, and it was part of the Wesleyan tradition to care about that. Same with the Reformed tradition out of Holland and out of Germany. A commitment to education and to helping others, a commitment to orphans. The founding of the Sunday school movement by Raikes was another situation where he just saw these kids outside of the kingdom, outside of the gospel, and he was thinking about how do we welcome them into the church? How do we welcome them in and teach them about the good news of Jesus Christ? And the whole Sunday school movement started. Ashley Cooper, some of you know about Lord Shaftesbury. He was a member of Parliament in the latter part of the 19th century, and one of the problems during that era was in the area of mining. And I chose this illustration because of the Chilean situation that we've just seen. Mining continues to be a very, very dangerous endeavor, and it's one that we've been dependent on and continue to be dependent on even in the 21st century. In that century, the best workers were often what we call now tweens. You know what a tween is? It's an 8 to a 12-year-old. Tween. Why? Because the technology was such that they had to lower children down or lower somebody down on a shaft. Then they would have to crawl in order to pull the coal car to get it out. And you can see it illustrated there. And they would do that for kids, and they'd work those kids for 12, sometimes 14 hours a day. If you've read any of Charles Dickens' works, you'll get a feel for what it was like in England during those days. And Shaftesbury was so burdened by this practice that he started to push the first thing, the 10 hours bill, and the second, the Mines Act. The reason he pushed the 10 hours bill is to let kids come back up after 10 hours and only have to work a 10-hour day. He couldn't get them out of the mines, but at least he could make the conditions better. They started rag schools and began to teach, and later on, subsequently, they passed the Mines Act, which actually started the process of getting children out of the mines. But that was a common practice. Another response. George Mueller, most of you know of Mueller. Now, what you might not know is that Mueller actually, in his sojourn prior to getting into the world of the world of orphans in Bristol, in England, he actually went to Halle. And he had exposure to Franca's work there, and what one person has said that he was, in fact, he even suggested that Franca was probably the religious father of Mueller. Now, I haven't chased that up in terms of its validity, but that was a claim that he made. Now, the interesting thing about Mueller is that he started to get a burden for children, burden for orphans, and he started orphanages. And in the end, he had started the four houses and covered over 2,000 cared for over 2,000 orphans. Now, one of the interesting things about Mueller is that Mueller was a kind of a faith guy. He would just trust God for everything. And one of the things that I have met is a lot of zealous young people that want to go down that same road. And I want to tell you that there were others beside Mueller doing this kind of thing, that is not the only model. It is a valid model, but it is not the only model. World vision, compassion, there are other models to do this. But Mueller was another example. So let's come forward. Those are kind of historical, post-reformational responses. But what's happening today? Well, the majority of orphans are AIDS orphans. And they're the biggest place that's been hit is Africa. And in Africa, you've got orphans as much as 20 to 25% of all children in parts of Africa, and that's a list of the countries. And the ironic thing about that is that those countries are continuing to see this happen. It isn't like a problem that was faced beyond. We continue to have to move the statistics and the graphs out. So we started to think about this, and some years ago, a study was done by Jeff Foster, and he began to look at what was going on to help those children. And what he discovered is that there are faith-based organizations, FBOs, principally congregations that are doing most of the work, small congregations, sometimes 100 members, 200 members. And of the faith-based organizations, the 322, they found that they were supporting 139,000 orphans, 322 congregations. That's in six different countries in Africa in the study. They also found that they were, those of 193 of them were pulling in almost 7,885 volunteers to touch those orphans' lives. And they're making a major difference. Brothers and sisters, in our day, the problem is as big as it has ever been. In fact, bigger if you look at the magnitude of it. But the responses are there, and God is working. And what I want to do tomorrow is to show you how your church and how the work of your church can begin to make a significant impact and begin to welcome children in the name of Jesus. Amen.